Almost every parent has left their child with a babysitter at some point in their adolescence. Whether it be a relative, a family friend, or simply somebody that we saw locally advertised. It doesn't matter how well we know them, how comfortable we feel in their competence and ability. There is always that niggling feeling of doubt, that fear that whispers so silently into your ear when you're trying to focus your energy elsewhere. The reminder that you are not aware of what is in the mind of the person you have placed in the care of your kin. A babysitter is not uncommon, going back for thousands of years across our ancestors, even crossing species into the animal kingdom as the wiser, more maternal of the group is entrusted to take care of the youths. As the parents of our children, we are entrusted to keep them safe. And in these short moments of our lives, we trust somebody else to take over this mantle, if not only for an evening. Almost every single time, these fearful thoughts remain just that. Thoughts. Never to manifest into anything more than a silly worry in the back of a mother's head. But then there's always the question. What if it isn't the babysitter that we need to fear? I'm Luke Mordew, and this urban legend is A Stranger Calls. As one of the most famous urban legends, to this day there are many out there that believe the story to be true, always happening to a girl that's a friend of a friend in the next town over. These stories, like so many other urban legends, fester in the dark recesses of our mind, changing the way we see the world and make action. Urban legends are nothing but folklore against a modern setting, that cling on to our anxieties and tease out the darkest parts of our imagination. Many exist around the campfire in the guise of spooky stories, whilst holding a more cautionary tale closer to its chest. But not this time. It seems the tale of A Stranger Calls exists merely to provoke the anxieties that would be inevitably felt by any teenager that was suddenly in charge of the well-being and safety of a child. Most of us don't have to imagine, but merely remember the mixture of that feeling of pride that you were so entrusted, that you were finally being seen as an adult, and terror that you were so clearly out of your depth, to care for a child whilst being a child yourself. Perhaps this is why the story has stayed with us for so long, and will most likely continue to do so for years to come. It is a manifestation of our anxiety. Whether you look at it from the parents' perspective or the babysitters, as quite frankly, both were helpless to stop the call. In my telling of the story, our babysitter is called Angela, looking after two children of the Mills family that slumber in their bed in their rooms upstairs. It was 1964 when Angela arrived at the Mills household just after sunset in that September Friday night. It had seemed to so many that the heat of summer had been ripped from the air, like a warm blanket torn from a cozy bed, leaving everyone in a sudden state of cool air and discomfort as they adjusted to the new temperature. Mr. Mills answered the door in a smart shirt and freshly pressed trousers, ready for his evening out with his wife. As she placed her bag of books on the floor, Mrs. Mills appeared in the landing at the top of the stairs, gently closing her children's door behind her. She smiled as she slowly crept down the stairs towards Angela. "Thank you so much for doing this. We really needed a night alone," she said with an excitement under a hushed tone to make sure she didn't disturb the sleeping children upstairs. They spent no longer than a couple of minutes giving a rundown of what Angela may need to know before scurrying out of the door. The simple things. The address for the local pizza delivery, the phone number to the restaurant they were visiting, an apology that they didn't own a television, and to make sure that she pulled the chain locked across the front door. Angela spent the next hour sitting comfortably on their large fabric sofa that rested in the cozy, clean, but very much lived-in lounge, studying for the science exam she could feel looming closer with each passing day. This job was a perfect opportunity to study and prepare without any distractions. A somewhat ironic sentiment now we look back at her tale. As she tapped her pencil impatiently against the pages of a book, frustrated that the words were turning into nothing but jumbled squiggles on the blank page, the phone rang for the first time. Angela dropped the books to her side, almost jumping at the opportunity for a breakaway from her studies, and walked to the corded phone across the room, instantly picking it up and placing it to her ear. She said hello, expecting to hear a voice somewhat startled by the sound of a teenage girl answering the phone, or perhaps it was Mr. and Mrs. Mills calling to make sure that everything was okay. But in the end, it was neither. All Angela heard down the other end of the phone was the slight, short breaths of a man as he listened back to her young, feminine voice. She said hello once more, appreciating that the caller may not have realized she'd picked up, or even that the line was potentially weak, but there was still no response. Merely the short breathing of the caller down the receiver of the phone. The innocent conclusions Angela had humored strayed further from the front of her mind, quickly replaced by the sinister realization that whoever was on the other side of the suspicious call was listening to her every breath. And with that, the phone cut off. Angela slowly placed the phone back down on the receiver but did not walk away, almost as if expecting it to ring again. Within moments, the comfortable evening of homework had been warped into an eerie night of loneliness and vulnerability, and this bothered her a great deal. In an attempt to break from the fearful spell of the stranger's call that seemed to bestow upon her, she headed straight back to the sofa to continue her studies, slumping down onto the fabric and pulling the books back onto her lap. But this time, she held the cushion close to her side, almost hugging it like a child would a teddy for comfort. She stared down at her pages, scanning through the first paragraph of her work as if nothing had happened, as if all was normal. This charade continued for only a moment before she slammed her pen onto the book with frustration. Not a single word had been absorbed into her consciousness, as the thoughts now whispering so aggressively in the back of her mind took up so much space. But even this frustrated pause was short-lived, as the shrill tones of the phone's ring began to bellow through the walls of the house. Her eyes instantly darted to the receiver that sat across the room, studying it, anxiety growing inside of her chest with every ring that sprang out. What if it was the Mills? She thought to herself as the worry of letting her employers down crept into her lungs to join the fear that had already twisted at her organs. With a sudden forced bravery, Angela jumped to her feet without any consideration for the books in her lap, causing them to slam to the floor by her feet. She paced fast across the room, each step faster than the one before, heading straight to the sharp sounds of the loud call ahead from her. She threw her hand down onto the phone so fast her palm slammed against the receiver as she gripped it, flinging it up to her ear. At first, there was silence once more, although she knew there was somebody amongst the subtle white noise of the device. And then it began. The slow, slight breathing began to seep through the small holes in the earpiece of the phone, vibrating through her ear and against her drum that in turn sent a cold shiver down her spine, as if the caller had somehow managed to physically touch her. And then they spoke. In a breathy, cold whisper, their voice broke the eerie ambience with a simple question.
Have you checked the children?
And with that, the phone clicked, and the dial tone began to ring out into the room. Angela slowly pulled the phone away from her ear, horrified by the events that were unfolding before her. She placed the receiver back onto the phone and watched it for a moment, almost afraid to turn away from it, as if the phantom on the other side would somehow crawl out. But she didn't have long to build this fear, as the phone's shrill scream echoed around the room once again. She instantly dove forward this time, almost as if ready to fight, but mostly in a frantic reflex to find out what was going on. The heavy, disturbed breathing continued for a far shorter amount of time as the caller asked once again, in the same monotone whispered voice that somehow managed to exude such sinister glee with every word.
Have you checked the children?
The caller instantly hung up, and Angela followed suit, slamming the receiver down onto the base with force. She didn't want to waste any time, giving this caller an extra opportunity to return, and so she darted out of the living room, pacing up that hall and into the kitchen, grabbing the envelope on the side that had the phone number scribbled on the back. She paced back into the living room, memorizing the number the best she could to speed things along as she hastily called the restaurants the Mills were dining in. A well-spoken woman answered with her best phone voice, introducing the restaurant as well as offering her assistance. Angela frantically asked if she could speak to the Mills that were there having dinner, so frantic it seemed to even startle herself, the fear twisting at her lungs inside of her chest, causing her breath to shorten. As the woman on the other end of the phone disappeared to get the Mills, Angela attempted to calm herself, forcing her feet from changing weight left to right in a panicked sway. The woman returned with an enthusiastic hello. "Hi," Angela sharply responded, eagerly wishing her away from the phone so she could speak to Mr. Mills. "I'm sorry, madam. Both Mr. and Mrs. Mills left here a quarter of an hour ago," the woman explained. The disappointment hit Angela like a plank of wood against her torso. As she thanked the woman and put down the phone, she began to contemplate why she was even calling the Mills to begin with. It wasn't like he could do anything to help. She herself could just go upstairs and check on the children. It was her job after all. But she was just a kid herself. And she was scared. Shaken to the core by this menacing figure that stood by a phone somewhere else in the world. The phone began to ring once again, causing her to jump out of her skin in fright. And in a somewhat strange, knee-jerk reaction, she grabbed the phone, lifting it off the receiver before slamming it back down, instantly hanging up on the caller. After taking a moment to gather her composure, she slowly walked to the doorway of the living room, peering up into the darkness of the landing upstairs. She could just make out the lines of the children's bedroom doors in the glow of the moonlight outside that shone through the frosting glass in the cold air. Everything seemed still, undisturbed, calm. Her thoughtful contemplation was interrupted once more by the shrill call of the receiver in the living room. She turned and paced inside, taking two deep breaths before pulling the phone to her ear. "Hello," she said hastily. This time there was no breathing. The caller wasted no time, as if getting impatient with her lack of willingness to leap into action.
"Why haven't you checked the children?"
the voice asked, maintaining its faint, breathy, whispered sound, although this was accompanied by a slightly frustrated growl that would seep through beneath each word. "Who is this?" she asked sharply, a newfound strength in her voice. And with that, the caller hung up once again. She dropped the phone to the floor, her fingers trembling in fear, her eyes filling with tears as she blankly stared at the wall ahead of her. How could they have possibly known I hadn't checked on the children? She began to ask herself in her frantic, terrified mind. She sharply turned to the large patio doors behind her that led straight into the black darkness of the Mills' large garden. She dove past the sofa, grabbing the curtains and yanking them closed as fast as she could, frantically untying the posh velvet rope that held them back. She backed away from them sharply, keeping her eyes fixated on them while she fumbled around on the floor for the phone. She picked it up and placed it to her ear, reaching out to dial the emergency services. When she was through to the operator of the police department, she begged for their help, panicked by the realization that this caller was somehow watching her. Nothing but a ball of anxiety as she sat on the ground by the phone, as if to keep herself hidden as much as possible. They told her it was going to be okay, and that they were going to help, which on so many levels was a hollow promise at that moment in time, but it worked. Angela had instantly stopped crying, listening with hope and relief as the operator explained that she needed to keep the caller on the line for longer than a minute. Whilst this happens, they will trace the call. Once they took her phone number and address, they simply added, "You need to remain calm. Can you do this for me?" And for some reason, Angela did feel calmer. She no longer felt that she was alone in this fight. She put the phone back onto the receiver, remaining on the floor as she waited patiently for the phone to ring. Partly wishing it to ring so the bastard on the other side could get caught, mostly hoping she would never hear from this caller again. After a moment, she scrambled to the light across the room, flicking it off, leaving only one lamp to light the room, desperately trying to keep herself hidden as best as possible from any unwelcome voyeurs that may have been peering through the cracks in the curtains. And then, finally, the phone rang once more. "Hello," she answered, stuttering over her words more than she intended, as if now suddenly working off a script that didn't exist. Caller asked in a menacing whisper, this time clearly trying to let her know that he could see her. She fought back the panic this induced and maintained her persistence to stick to the goal. "Can you see me?" she asked, still stuttering over her words, the tremble of her voice clear for all to hear. The caller simply replied,
"Yes,
a dash of gleefulness seeping through their words. "Look, you've scared me," she said with a sudden burst of bite. "I'm shaking. Is this what you wanted?" The caller's breathing grew heavy once again as they listened to her panicked breaths, taking in every moment in what she imagined was pure joy for them. Click. The caller hung up the phone once more. In her frustration, Angela slammed the phone back down onto the receiver, fighting back the tears as much as she could as she gently rocked back and forth, still desperately trying to control her breathing. It didn't take long for the phone to ring again, and this time Angela had enough. She grabbed the phone before it had even finished its first ring, pulling the phone to her ear and screaming, "What do you want from me?" "Angela," said a nervous voice on the other end. It was the operator. We traced the call. It was coming from inside the house. "You need to get out. Get out. Now," they rapidly exclaimed down the phone, each word growing more panicked than the last. Angela didn't hesitate, slamming the phone down as she jumped to her feet. She darted into the hallway, turning to the living room door to escape. She reached it and pulled it open, but as sharply as hanging up a phone call, it suddenly stopped with a loud clang. In her illogical panic, she pulled it again before remembering that she had locked the chain above. She pushed it closed and lifted her body on her tiptoes to reach the high chain that had connected the frame to the door, the cold air already stinging her cheeks from outside, reminding her of just how close she was to escape. But this would be the last time she felt that cold air as the new source of light began to spread across the door from behind. She turned to see the peaceful landing that shone in the faint white light of the moon above was now being joined by the hot red glow of the children's nightlight as the door slowly opened, revealing the sinister figure of the caller who had been waiting upstairs all along. Angela turned and yanked the chain from the door as a sinister figure charged down the stairs to finally capture their prey. The phone began to ring once again, its shrill calls echoing through the house that sat quietly in the darkness of the frosty night. But that front door never opened. Putting aside the logistical improbability of what the police managed to pull off in this story, we are left with a haunting cautionary tale, and just like all good urban legends, the tale holds weight for a variety of reasons from person to person. Some see it as nothing more than a frightening story to tell by the campfire. Others see it as a warning of the vulnerability that all young women face. More often than not, it is a tale that tells babysitters to do their job well. If our young Angela had gone and checked the children earlier, she perhaps could have saved them. Perhaps she could have also saved herself. Although this moral interpretation tips the scale of reason onto the side of victim blaming, and that's something I'm not too comfortable in doing. So for me, this is merely a scary story to keep you on your toes when you're alone. And to this day, the possibility that this occurrence could actually happen is never too far from any babysitter's mind. The urban legend itself was first imprinted into the history of cinema as early as 1971 in Foster's Release, a short story inspired by the apparent events of that fictional night. It was only 3 years later that the story would grow to a more mainstream audience, inspiring the cult classic Black Christmas, which has now gone down in history as one of the very first slashers that would inspire the most famous names and masked faces we know so well in modern pop culture. In fact, this story was brought to the screen on 5 different occasions in the 70s alone, solidifying the story in the minds of the everyday citizen. And our stranger on the phone had become a household name, so to speak, with the terrifying "When a Stranger Calls" by Fred Walton in 1979. Since then, the story's been told several times, whether it be through short films, television, or feature-length production, each one putting their own little spin on the harrowing tale. We all remember the infamous line, "What's your favourite scary movie?" from the 1997 classic Scream, in which a young Drew Barrymore is taunted over the phone by a masked killer. This scene was a homage to the film When a Stranger Calls that reenacted this legend. To this day, this story continues to linger in Western folklore, adapting and changing to new environments and smarter technology. But what if we were to go the other way? venturing back to the very first instance of the story.
Was this legend true or completely fabricated?
In reality, the truth is somewhere in the middle.
All right, I think I hacked in.
We're on the air?
Shh, security's outside.
But how's my hair?
It's a radio station.
Psst, psst. You guys hear about the Beyond the Shadows podcast with Ryan and Scott?
You guys into paranormal?
What about true crime?
How about UFOs and cryptids?
We also have mad hauntings.
We got security.
No, we don't. We're not big enough to need it yet.
No, we got security.
Hey, what are you guys doing? Get out of here! Listen to the Beyond the Shadows podcast.
Beyond the Shadows!
The responses and reviews for Urban Legends have been a wonderful surprise for us here, and we're over the moon that our listeners are enjoying our content. Although it hasn't gone unnoticed that many of you have commented that you wish there was more content from us. This is why we've begun a Patreon with two tiers. For £4 a month, you can join us as a mythologist, where you can catch all episodes of Urban Legends without any of these ad breaks, allowing you to focus on the story at hand, as well as exclusive hidden episodes released the Monday after each legend, delving into similar legends not covered in the main series. For £8 a month, you can join us as an anthropologist, where you can catch all that I previously mentioned, as well as the ability to put your version of the legend forward to be read in the main series, invitations to live Q&As with me, work-in-progress updates, priority voting on what legends we'll cover in the seasons to come, and even the chance to feature on one of our footnotes. The more our Patreon grows, the more content we can create, and the shorter our breaks between seasons become. So, we hope you'll join us soon. And now, back to the podcast. Janet was only a few days away from her 14th birthday when her school, Jefferson Junior High School, were hosting an unrelated dance party for the students that attended on that cold Saturday of the 18th of March 1950. Janet had been invited to attend with some friends, but unfortunately for all involved, she declined. You see, Janet had already promised her night away to Mr. and Mrs. Romack, babysitting. Janet had previously sat for two families, the Romacks and the Muellers, who were all close friends of each other's, and I can only speculate that the information was passed in between, as often is the case of babysitters. When the sun finally began to set and twilight laid its blanket of royal blue over the cold sky, Janet arrived at a Romack's house in the passenger seat of Ed Romack's car, having picked her up from her home. Once there, Anne Romack would explain that little Gregory would sleep with the radio on, and that he shouldn't be any trouble at all. Ed Romack, on the other hand, gave Janet a crash course in how to load, unload, and fire a shotgun for safety measures in case anything was to occur. This shotgun was placed by the front door with the instructions to turn on the porch light outside if anyone came knocking. Once the Romacks were happy to do so, they locked the front door and left for a night of card games and laughter with friends. They were lucky to leave when they did, as the weather outside began to rapidly worsen, as the sharp winds flung rain and sleet through the cold air that was rapidly dropping at a considerable rate, blanketed by the booming sound waves of the thunder and lightning that blasted above. It was 10:35 p.m. when a call rang through the steady offices of Boone County Sheriff's Department. Officer Ray McCowan calmly picked up the receiver and asked what the emergency was. What he was met with was the haunting howls of a woman calling out in sheer terror. Blood-curdling screams sent a shiver down his spine as fast as any gust outside could do. "Come quick," he heard her call through her frantic panic. Before he could even think to intervene, the phone line was cut short. With nothing but a dial tone ringing through his ears, Officer McGowan knew that this was no prank call. He knew what he had just heard was real, and yet there was simply nothing he could do about it. The call had been too short to provide a trace. All he could do was wait in tense anticipation with nothing but sheer hope that the phone would ring again. But in his heart of hearts, he knew.
that she was never going to call again. Later into the night, Ed Romack called his home to check on everything from the Moon Valley Villa where he was with his wife. But there was no answer. Hours later, at roughly 1:30 in the morning, the Romacks arrived at their home to find their porch light was switched on and the front door blinds were open. They approached the front door and Ed fiddled with the keys, but as they drew closer, they found it was already unlocked. Confused by this, they sharply stepped inside of their home to find the not yet 14 years old little girl, Janet Chrisman, sprawled out across the living room floor surrounded by her own blood, soaking into the fabric of the carpet. Her clothes were disheveled, her legs spread as she laid cold on the ground, now only half-dressed. There was a head wound from a blunt instrument and multiple puncture wounds by what seemed to be a metallic pencil. But most notably, it was the cord of an electric iron that had been cut and wrapped tightly around her neck. As they entered the room, Anne noticed a landline phone dangling off the hook, explaining why Ed could not get through earlier. And with that realization, a sudden gut-wrenching panic twisted her stomach to her chest. She turned and darted to the stairs, pacing up them as fast as she could to her baby boy Greg, who miraculously laid calmly, still asleep, completely oblivious to the torment and horror that had occurred a few feet below. Inside the home were clear indications of an altercation. Janet had fought back against her attacker. Blood smears and fingerprints were found in both the living room and the kitchen, where the back door was unlocked and left ajar, standing above a pool of blood. The police followed this trail to find a male footprint left in the mud near a side window that had been shattered with a garden hoe. This led several police investigators to the conclusion that this was the point the perpetrator had gained entry into the house. But others disagreed. Many detectives believed that, due to the strict instructions given to Janet by Ed Romack, whoever arrived at a house with ill intent knew Janet and gained entry through the front door, acting as a friend. This theory is backed up by the fact that the porch light was turned on, as Ed had told her to do if anybody came to it. The theory was also backed up by the fact that the shotgun was untouched, and the fact the killer seemed to know where to locate the electric iron, to use its cord as the weapon of choice. Although this tragic event shocked a town to its very core, it was not the first of its kind in the area. Only 4 years earlier, on the 5th of February 1946, a 20-year-old girl by the name of Mary Lou Jenkins was brutally murdered in an alarmingly similar way to Janet. Mary Lou was home alone, less than a mile from where Janet would be murdered 4 years later, whilst her mum spent the evening a mere few houses away tending to an elderly couple while her father was out of town on business. Mary Lou and her mother had a clever little way of communicating through the darkness of the night. The idea was to simply turn on the light, lift up the window shades, and make a phone call. Later that night, Mary Lou's mum looked out of the elderly couple's window to see the shades across the street were up, and the lights were on. But as she had received no phone call, she didn't think anything of it. This would prove to be a grave error on her part, as she arrived home to find her daughter lying dead on the living room floor. She had been raped and strangled with an extension cord. It was only a fortnight later that Floyd Corcoran, a 35-year-old man, was arrested for the vicious murder. He had willingly admitted without any remorse that he had murdered his wife, and then unsuccessfully tried to take his own life. Due to the timeline of the murders and the Boone County's desperation to have Mary Lou's murder solved, something happened that we hear far too often. After 10 hours of interrogation, Floyd admitted to the crime of raping and murdering Mary Lou Jenkins, even though not a single shred of evidence placed him at the scene. Floyd was put to death on the 26th of September 1947 by gas chamber, but a mere few hours before the execution, he recanted his alleged confessions of Mary Lou, and it was later concluded that he was coerced by the police to give a false confession. But by this point, it was too late, and Mary Lou's death is, to this day, considered solved. It had seemed that the arrest of Floyd Corcoran and the later Peeping Tom, Jake Bradford, had left the town feeling settled once again. That was until the murder of Janet Chrisman reignited the flames into a bushfire that spread across the many voices of the nearby residents.
With an alarming amount of parallels between Mary Lou's and Janet's murders, the whispers of doubt of the police original affirmation had begun. As the investigation into Janet Christman's murder continued, one promising suspect had made its way to the forefront of many investigators' minds. Robert Mueller. With a large amount of evidence, albeit circumstantial, beginning to stack up against him. Mueller was 27 years old, a friend of Ed Romack's in school, and was an Army Air Corps captain with a distinguishable record during his service in World War II. After, he returned to Columbia to look after his father's restaurant, as well as working as a tailor. He was often remembered for being a well-dressed gentleman who was known to carry a mechanical pencil in his jacket pocket or shirt. After the war, Robert Mueller and Ed Romack grew close once again, spending more and more time together with their mutual friends. Even so, Ed would later explain that Robert had what he called a lustful eye for virgin women, and spoke often of having a desire to defile someone young. On top of this, and far more damning, Robert knew Janet, since she had also babysat for them on numerous occasions. And Robert had apparently made lewd and lecherous comments to Ed about her well-developed hips and breasts. On top of these alarming signs of guilt is the fact that Ed Romack received a phone call from Robert the morning after the murder. He was offering his assistance to clean up the mess, although this itself was dubious, as not even the press had printed the tragedy of the events that unfolded. With an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence, the police arrived at Robert Mueller's residence to speak with him, but rather than following the basic guidelines of an arrest, the officers decided not to take him into custody, and instead transported him to the officer's home. Later, he was taken to the state capital, Jefferson City, where he was given a polygraph test and passed. To cut a long story of mix-ups, frustrating incidents, and incompetence short, Robert Mueller was never charged with any crime. To this day, the horrifying events that unfolded for Janet Christman remain unsolved, lost in the darkness of the cold night, only to live on in legend. Most stories we hear, even those from our own lives and memories, are filled with misunderstandings, misinterpretations, embellishments, and indulgences. The way word of mouth can inspire and evolve an event into a scary story that bears such little resemblance to the original source. Even the urban legend itself has several interpretations. For example, the far softer ending of the story, that ends with the caller turning out to be one of the children who decided to scare the babysitter as a prank, only to be eventually told off by the police. There is the most common version, where the babysitter escapes, but the children, sadly, do not. There is the version of events where the babysitter somehow manages to rescue the children and the caller upstairs is arrested by the police. Even this version has two alternate endings, with the caller telling our babysitter, "See you soon," before being taken away, and a version where he says nothing at all. There's another version of a tale where the caller doesn't speak at all, merely making creepy, unnerving noises, giggling and heavy breathing down the phone to our babysitter. Later in this version, when the operator tells our babysitter the calls are coming from inside the house, the phone is quiet. After a moment's pause, the operator asks if the babysitter is still there, only to hear the same noises she once heard, insinuating it was too late for the babysitter and she had, in fact, been killed. In another version of the tale, the children are still awake and watching television with our babysitter. When the caller begins to phone them, he tells them he'll be with them in a certain amount of time. Eventually, just as they get the news the calls are coming from inside the house, they hear a door upstairs opening, followed by the footsteps heading down the stairs towards them in the living room. This version of the tale can be found in the famous children's horror stories collection, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. In some film interpretations of the story, years after the events, the babysitter is now an adult and has a family of her own. One evening, she is out with her husband enjoying a wonderful dinner together, whilst the babysitter is looking after their children. The evening is wonderful, romantic, and full of laughter, until the waiter approaches the table to let them know a phone call is waiting. When she heads to the phone and picks up the receiver, she is asked by a menacing voice, "Did you check the children?" Followed by what I imagine is a very dramatic musical score. In a creepypasta interpretation of the story, the babysitter is increasingly unnerved by a life-size statue of a clown in the room. When the parents call to check the children, the babysitter mentions a terrifying clown statue, explaining it's putting her on edge, asking for permission to cover it with a sheet. The confused parents cautiously tell her that they do not own a clown statue in the living room. At this moment, the babysitter is attacked by the clown, a murderer in disguise. Perhaps this legend remains so ingrained in our society as it's something we can all relate to in some way. So many of us have been the babysitter at some point in our young lives, after years of craving some form of responsibility, only to receive it and find fear and excitement swirling together in a naive sensation of being an adult. The scary story of a babysitter attacked at her most vulnerable was so appealing as a scary story, as we have all felt that vulnerability of being home alone with responsibility. Not just fearing for yourself, but for those you've been put in charge of. The idea that someone could be wanting to get in, watching you through the window, or worse, already in the house, is a concept that could make any child or adult shudder at the thought. That is what gives this legend its power. Its adaptability, its absurdity, and yet, its familiarity.
Urban Legends is written and produced by Luke Mordew. Research by Sean Davis, in association with Mordew Pictures. Music by Billy Jar. If you like what you've heard and want to hear more, make sure to click subscribe. You can find out more about Urban Legends, including a complete written breakdown of this episode, with images, news reports, and citations listed on anything that's been said at lrmordew.com/podcast. Follow us on Twitter at ulpodcast, on Instagram at urbanlegends.podcast, or on Facebook by simply searching Urban Legends Podcast.